Let me begin this morning with not necessarily an apology. Chaucer himself makes the apology, and we'll look at it. But let me just tell you my first experience of reading The Miller's Tale. I mentioned yesterday that there was a great high school English teacher. Her name was Pearl Lamphere, unmarried, tough. I never got to have her. She's the one who made all her students in high school learn the opening of the general prologue in Middle English. So I wasn't lucky enough, and by the time I got to senior English, we looked at the Canterbury Tales in translation. I don't remember, I think we just looked at the general prologue in translation, but I wanted to read some more, so I was reading the tales. I had no direction, I didn't know what I was reading. I was sitting in study hall one morning, and picked it up, and I'd read The Knight's Tale and thoroughly enjoyed it, and started reading The Miller's Tale, not knowing what it was, in total ignorance and as much innocence as a 17-year-old can have. Well, I became hysterical. I started laughing, and you know that terrible feeling when you're trying to suppress laughter? You're in an inappropriate place, and you dare not laugh, and it's welling up, and the more you try to control it. And then the further I read, the funnier it got. And, of course, I got to the end of it with that magnificent explosion of ordered chaos. Well, I lost it. I was guffawing. I was shaking. I was howling with laughter. And the teacher overseeing the study hall told me to be quiet at once, and I couldn't stop. It was coming from down here in my belly and just gales until I was sent to the principal's office. Now, I was valedictorian that year. I was a star pupil. And suddenly I'm in the principal's office. And he looked at me, said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I was just thrown out of study hall." And he was absolutely stunned. He said, "What were you doing?" I said, "Reading Chaucer." He looked vaguely puzzled and said, "Well, don't do it again." That was my introduction to The Miller's Tale. The reason I tell the story is the simple fact of the matter. It is one of those naughty tales. I'll explain where it comes from in just a moment. But the fact of the matter is, it's funny. It's old-fashioned comedy. On a level at which comedy works, I'll say more about this when I come to Midsummer Night's Dream, but let me just put it this way. One of the functions of comedy is to bring us back down to earth, remind us of our common humanity and our frailties. And The Miller's Tale does it in spades, because we're looking at man at his lowest, if you will, subject to base desires and getting rewarded for that, appropriately so. The other side, of course, is it's a bawdy story. And I use that term advisedly because I think there is a very important difference between bawdiness and obscenity. Bawdiness, and The Miller's Tale is a bawdy story, bawdiness deals with those aspects of human life we don't often talk about. Those lower functions, if you will. They're not appropriate for civilized conversation. It's not the sort of thing one discusses in public. It's a part of life. It's there. And bawdiness recognizes the fact of that lower animal nature of our lower animal nature, and does so with a bit of a chuckle, finding something amusing there. But it does not dwell on it, obsess about it, or revel in it. Whereas the obscene really does. And we get an example of that, and I'm not even going to look at it. The Reeves Tale, which follows The Miller's Tale, is truly filthy. There's no wit. There's very little structure or organization. It's not a clever story. The Reeve simply attacks the Miller, and it's simply a filthy story. The Reeve's Tale is, if you will, the real bottom. It's bad. The Miller's Tale is funny. The Miller's Tale is funny. And there is about the Miller, and we'll see in a second, he's noted for it. He's one of those guys who can tell a joke. he's one of those that would be, you know, you get him together in company and he's going to have everyone laughing because he has the ability to say things that probably shouldn't be said, but to say it in a clever, imaginative, unusual way that's funny. And as a result, he shows his skill when he tells his little story. But not to a good end, okay? But Chaucer's using that tale for a very particular purpose. The other thing is this. There is that sense, and we know, Scripture tells us, there are certain things that should not be spoken of in public. And that's absolutely true. The fact of the matter is, there are times when people do speak of them. Chaucer's aware of that. It's part of human life. He's using it. I don't know how many of you know the great American musical, The Music Man. It's one of my favorites. It's quite wonderful. But the heroine of that is the town librarian. And the mayor's wife and the other snootish women in the town don't like her at all. And one of her objections is that she was befriended by the man who owned the library, okay? And when he died, as they say, it's in a little song, he gave River City the library building, but he left all the books to her. So the city owns the building, the librarian owns the books, and their objection is she keeps on the shelves for the children to read filthy books. And the authors they list are Chaucer, Rabelais, Balzac. And they become, it appears a couple of times in the song. It's that notion that there's something not quite right there. Now, I want to go back to a point I made yesterday, which is this. The tales are connected to the teller. Chaucer is giving us a cross-section of medieval humanity, and we are getting insights into those individuals by the tales they tell. I skipped over the miller in the prologue yesterday. Let's turn there now and see how he's described in the general prologue when we first meet him. you can probably find it. Let me see. I can give you a page number fairly quickly. It's page... Now, if somebody comes up with it, shout it out. 15? 17. Okay, thank you. Yep, very bottom, page 17. That's where it begins. Again, I'll read the Middle English. The miller was astute carle for the nonus. Full big he was of brawn and ache of bonus. This is a big man, okay? Big bony man. That proved well, for over all there he come. At wrestling he wolde have alway the ram. Whenever he wrestles, he wins. Nobody can beat him. He's a tough cookie, okay? Best image of him, big, brawny, tough, vulgar guy. Think of the governor of Minnesota. He was short-shouldered, broad, a thicker canara. There was no Dora that he knolled a haver of Hara, or Brecket at a renning with his head. There's no door he couldn't knock down, or if it was locked, he could go right through it with his head. We're talking tough here. This may be something he's done for a while, which may explain his thought processes as well. His beard as any sewer fox was rayed, and thereto broad as though it were a spada. Upon the cop ricked of his nosa, he had a huerta, and thereon stored a tuft of hairs, rayed as the brussels of a sow's heiress. His nosa thurless blaker were and weeder. A sword and buckler bare he by his seda. Now notice, he's a miller, he's a workman, but he carries a sword and shield with him. This is a guy who's always ready for a fight. Okay? He's ready to be on the attack at any moment. We're going to see it happen. His mouth as great was as a great fornice. He has this gigantic mouth, and it's compared to a huge cauldron. It's amazing. He was a jangler and a goliardice. He was noted for specifically a jangler, a teller of dirty stories, and a buffoon. Once again, he's that fellow that every, you know, hey, I heard, you want to hear a good one? And you say, oh, well, no, you got to hear this one. And you half listen because you know he's going to tell it well and it's going to be funny, okay? This is a type. They're still out there. You know some of them. We won't name names. And that was most of Cinna and Harlotries. When he's telling these stories, they're tales about sin and obscenity. That's what he talked, that's what his mouth is. Well, could he steal in corn and toll in threes? He'd steal the grain, okay? He's a grain stealer. He may be a miller, but he's stealing other people's grains. And when he's taking tolls, he'll collect them three times. He's a thief. And yet he had a thumb of gold, perdi. Ironic reference. The idea at the time was there are no honest millers. But no, he's so perfect. His thumb is very gold. Well, it's ironic. It's ironic. A wheat cot and a blue hod were it hay. A bag of peepa well could he blow and sona, and therewithal he brought us out of tuna. He's playing the bagpipe as they leave on their journey. He is the one who plays them out of town. They leave according to his music. Again, if we're going to the holy city, if we're going to the shrine, if we're making our pilgrimage to the place, the ending place, the spiritual place, we're starting in the worldly city, and if the last words we hear are the words of the parson in his sermon, we begin, if you will, riding to the miller's tune. Riding to the miller's tune. He's the one who's making the worldly music as everyone leaves town, okay? That's who this man is. That's who this man is. Now, let me make a point. He is not stupid by any means. I guess then in that way he's different from your governor. He is a very clever man, a very clever man. The knight finishes his story. Harry Bailey compliments him. All of the other pilgrims have loved listening to the knight's tale, and Harry Bailey, our host, turns to the monk and says to the monk, now why don't you tell us a story, okay? Why don't you tell us something to follow the knight's tale? And the miller, who is drunk, this is in the prologue to the miller's tale, the miller that for drunken was all pala, so that a neth upon his horse he sought, he can barely sit on his horse, he's so drunk, he nolled avail neither hod nor hot nor beaded no man for his courtesia, but in Pilate's voice he gan to cry. He cries with the voice of Pilate. That simply, it's from the old medieval mystery plays, and Pilate always shouted and ranted, okay? And swore by armis and by blood and bonus, e con a nobler tala for the nonus, with which e will now quita the canictus tala. Forget the monk, I'm going to tell a story now, he shouts. I'll tell a noble tale. You thought that tale was noble? I'll tell you a noble story, he says. But notice what else he says. With which he will now quita the canictus tala. I'll respond to the knight's tale. Okay? The phrase still survives. Unrequited love is love that is not returned. Okay? So to quite the knight's tale means to return something to the knight's tale. He is making the claim he is going to answer the knight's tale. And what this means is he is smart enough to have understood what the knight was talking about. And he is now going to respond with his own little noble story. Or hosta sock that he was drunk of Allah. Harry Bailey sees the guy is just tooted, right? And say that, abide we be in my leave abroad, or some better man shall tell us first another. Abide and let us work and thriftily. You're drunk. You're not going to tell your story now. We'll have somebody else tell the story right now. Be God a sola, quote he, that will not I, for he will spake or else go my way. Notice the oath. By God's soul, I will not, okay? I will not let somebody else tell another story. Notice the line is brilliantly constructed. I will do what I want to do by God's soul. Who's in charge? He is. Already we should see where this tale is going to go. If the knight's tale is about submitting to providence and God's will, the miller, before he even tells his tale, says, uh-uh. God's will, forget it. I'm going to do what I want to do by God's soul. And you let me tell my tale or I'm out of here. And at that point, okay, ur host answer the telan a devil why, thou art a fool, thy wit is overcome. Oh, okay. We'll put up with you. Now, the miller announces what the tale is going to be about. He's going to tell a legend in the life about a carpenter and his wife, and how a clerk gets the carpenter's, wins the carpenter's cap, he calls it. Nightcap, place in the bed, okay? The reeve gets angry instantly. Before the miller's even started his tale, he's provoking a battle. The reeve would have been a carpenter. So the reeve takes it personally that he knows the miller's about to tell a story that is going to make fun of a carpenter. And the reeve gets angry. The knight's tale brings them all together in delight. Before the miller even begins talking, we've got battles erupting. and the miller says to him, oh, quiet down, okay? I said that the carpenter in my story is cuckolded. Another man gets his wife. I didn't say that you were one, okay? There have been four good weavers, many on, and ever 1,000 good aeons on Nevada. There are 1,000 good wives for one bad one. You know that yourself. Why are you angry with my tale? I have a wife per day as well as thou. Hey, I have a wife too. Yet nolda I for the oxen in me ploch tak upon me more than enough, as demon of myself that I will own. Hey, I've got a wife, but I don't worry whether or not she's made me a cuckold. I don't worry about her infidelity. I will believe a well that I am none, and husband shall not ben inquisitive of God as privity, nor of his wife. A man shouldn't try to figure out what God is all about, nor question what his wife does. This is extraordinary. But then he explains why. So he may fiend a God his foison there, of the remnant nadeth not inquire. As long as he gets what he wants, then he shouldn't worry about what else his wife is doing. As long as his wife is there for him, as long as he gets his desire, then the rest of her time is her own. It's absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. But again, what have we got? Personal desire and personal will. Hey, as long as I'm happy, that's all I care about. As long as I get my will, that's all I care about. As long as my desires are satisfied, that's all I care about. And beyond that, don't question, don't ask, and then you'll be a happy man. Be dumb and satisfied and don't ask. Notice already what we're getting. I mean, I'm calling this sort of the second way, if you will. This is not the high road to the heavenly city. This is the miller's way of getting through the world dumb and happy. Just dumb and happy. Don't ask questions. Don't ask questions about your wife, and don't try to figure out God. Don't bother. Just make sure your desires are satisfied and be settled with that. Now, Chaucer, the pilgrim, immediately, as I said yesterday, sort of lacking in brightness as he is, he already catches on there's something wrong here. And he now tells us, well, watch out. Here comes a story that you may not want to read, okay? And he says, therefore every gentle wichty prya for goddess love dameth not that he sigh of evil intent. Don't think I'm doing this with evil intent. But for e mote rehearsa her talis alla be thy betra or worsa, or else false in some of my matera. I've got to tell all the tales. Please don't think I'm doing this in order to be naughty. But I have promised to write down everybody's story, And if I leave certain ones out, I will be false to my intent. What we grasp from that is that the intent in writing down all the stories is to show a complete cross-section of lived life at the time. And he says, I won't leave anybody out. And I will tell the tales they told. And it is not my intent to offend you. It's my intent to be completely honest about who all these people were and how they lived. Therefore, I gotta tell this story. And therefore, whoso listit not I hira, turna over the leif and chase another tala. If you don't want to hear this, turn the page. It's quite wonderful. You don't have to read this, okay? For he shall find no great and smaller of storial thing that toucheth gentleness and eke morality and holiness. If you keep turning through the stories, you're going to find some very nice ones. You will find good, pious stories that you will enjoy reading, so jump ahead. And, of course, everybody reads The Miller's Tale. What is this thing? Why is the author himself telling us, don't read this thing, okay? Proving that we have those, proving, if you will, our own fallen nature in a way. What is this? What's going on here? Why is the author himself warning us against this, okay? Blameth not me if that ye chase amiss, okay? It's not my fault if you choose the wrong tale to read. I put lots of good ones in here. The miller is a churl. You can know well this. Okay. This guy's a pig. You know it. So you can guess what kind of tale he's going to tell. And he does. Okay. It's a bawdy tale. But it's within a certain tradition. And this tale comes from a very popular kind of story out of 13th century France called the Fabliau. F-A-B-L-I-A-U-X. Fabliau. Quickest definition of the Fabliau, a short bawdy story told in verse. Okay? Deliberately scurrilous, obscene, very straightforward. They were very popular in the middle and lower classes. Fact of the matter is, you've got to have some degree of art in order to tell it, because it's written in verse. Okay? This isn't just, haphazard. It takes a little bit of artistic design, it takes a little intelligence, but it's bawdy, and it's delighting in the bawdiness, as the miller is delighting in telling this story in such company. He's having a good time. He's insisted on telling it. But again, let's go back. He is telling it against the Knight's Tale. He is telling it deliberately in response to the Knight's Tale. Great critic of Chaucer, a man named Bernard Huppé, wrote a book nearly half a century ago and went to the core of the spiritual nature of the Canterbury Tales, has a brilliant exposition where he points out how the Miller's Tale, even in its structure, is mocking the Knight's Tale. Look what we have here. We have old John the Carpenter. Old John the Carpenter, who should be, if you will, the head of his household, the wise old man. We have a Theseus figure. We have his 18-year-old wife. Okay? We have his 18-year-old wife, and he's newly married. He's very jealous of her. And she's a beauty. She's a beauty. What's happened? He's laid eyes on her, and his desire's gotten the better of him, and he's married her. Notice what we've got. We have someone looking at a beautiful young woman and falling in love with her. And we have two young men who also want her. Just as in the Knight's Tale. We have Nicholas, the Clerk of Oxford, as he's called, Hendy Nicholas, a little delightful pun there. He's clever and he's good with his hands, as we find out during the story. Hendy Nicholas and Absalom, who is a clerk in the parish who's also in love with her. So we have two young men who have fallen in love with the young woman. It's just like Palamon and Arcite. He is struck. This guy is smart. He may be drunken, he may be half falling off his horse, but he's got a quick wit. And he comes up with this fablio and he creates it instantly. But notice what he does. We don't have the wise guiding figure of Theseus. It's as if the Theseus figure had looked at Emily and fallen in love with her and wanted her as well, along with the two guys. So the first assertion that the miller is making is, hey, don't give me this vision of the wise old man who knows and understands and who's lived and who's above love. Forget it. Every man in the world is filled with desire and they'll all fall. You put a beautiful woman in front of them, they'll all fall. That's the assertion he's making right from the start, okay? And then he revels in the detail of presenting the young wife. If you remember, in The Knight's Tale, when the two young men look out of the prison window and see Emilia walking in the garden, we don't get an extended description of her. We are simply told that she's beautiful. It's the month of May, the garden is beautiful, and there's a beautiful young woman walking in the garden. That's all we need to know. But here, the miller delights in giving us details about how beautiful the 18-year-old wife is. Right near the beginning of the tale, where the carpenter is talking about, where the miller is describing the carpenter having wed a young wife. We're on page, very top of page 90. Very top of page 90. Okay. Fair was this younger weef, and therewithal is any waisle her body gent and small. Her body is as gentle and small as a weasel. It's just an astonishing comparison. But notice what he's doing. In paying her a compliment, he's already telling us something about her character. It's just a riot. A sign she wearied, barred all of silk, a barm cloth as wheat as morn a milk, upon her lenders full of many a gore, wheat was her smock and broid and all before her, and ache behind on her collar a boota of coal black silk, within and ache with uta. She is dressed in black and white, okay? We don't have delicate colors here. We've got the two extremes here. We've got the two extremes, if you will. The tapis of her wheat of voluper were of the same suit as her color, her fillet broad of silk and set full here, and sickly she had a licorous ear. She has a lecherous eye. In the midst of this beautiful young woman, she's got an eye on her. Okay. She's got an eye on her. For smally appalled were her brow was two, and though were bent and black as any sloe. Her very eyebrows were like little delicate fruits. Okay. We're going to get a whole set. We've had the comparisons with milk, with fruit, all of these edible objects. What does she do? She increases the appetites of those who look on her. They want to eat her up. And the miller knows it. Okay. And he's using this in his description. She was full more blissful on to say than is the new aperijonet tray. She is as beautiful as those, as beautiful to look on as the pear tree when the little pears are just becoming ripe. The pear tree had connections with adultery. Always. In the merchant's tale, we're gonna see it go all the way there, okay? But already, little hints. She's as beautiful to look on as a pear tree when the pears are just ripe. And again, the miller, he's a clever guy, he knows what he's implying there. And softer than the warla is of a weather, and be her girdle hang a purse of leather, tasseled with silk and pearled with latoon, in all this world to sake an open doon, there is no man so wees that could athencha, so gay a populare switch a wencha. You would not find another one like her if you looked up and down the whole world. We have been given, it goes on, I'll just stop there. He's delighting. He's reveling in giving us these details. He is, if you will, making her attractive to the listeners as well, so that we will understand why all men desire her. The thing not to be forgotten, however, she's married. She may be 18. She may have married an old man. She's a married woman. Okay? Now, they have a tenant in their house. It's young Nicholas. Okay? He lives with them. He's a clerk. We're at Oxford. This is deliberately set at Oxford because the miller is mocking learning. The knight may have presented a very learned tale, okay? Full of intelligence and culture and design and, well, we see where it gets us. And there may even be a slam. Remember the young clerk of Oxford, the thin guy on the thin horse who's very studious. This may be an attack on him. He's already attacked the reeve. Now the miller's making a little slam on the clerk. I know about clerks at Oxford. I know what you're up to. Yeah, I know what your studies are all about. I'll tell you about a clerk at Oxford. So he sets his story in Oxford, the center of learning. Yeah, right. You just hear him sneering all the way through this story. At everybody and everything, okay? That on a day, this Hendy Nicholas fill with this younger wife to Raj and Playa, okay? They're sporting with each other and having a little play with each other. The husband's gone. Will that her husband was at Osanaya. As clerk has been full subtle and full quainta, and privily he cocked her by the quainta. And sighed he whispered, if he have me willa, for derna love of thee, le man, he spilla. I'll die if you don't love me back. Notice we're getting the same kind of rhetoric we got from Palamon and Arcite. I will die if I don't have my beloved. But that is not a high courtly love. It may have been a worldly love, but there was a touch of nobility about it. This is just pure old animal desire that the miller is presenting here. That's all it is. And she, this is the miller again. And held her harder by the haunch of bones. He's just holding on to her. He won't let her go. And sighed, a lemon love me all at honest, or he will dee, and also God me sava. And she sprung as a colt doth in the trava, and with her head she reared fast away, and sighed, he will not kiss her thee by me fair. Why, let be, quoth she, let be, Nicholas, or I will create her ruined, alas, do weigh your handers for your courtesia. Who do you think you are, young man? Unhand me. Within about another 10 lines, she's given in. Okay? Get a little bit. This Nicholas Gan, merci for to Crea. Have mercy on me. Please remember how the Knight's Tale opened. The women who come and beg for mercy from Theseus. This tale's beginning with the young man going and crying mercy of the sensuous woman. Who's in charge here? The sensuous young woman. And the miller's aware of that. And he has already made the point in saying, hey, don't worry if your wife's cuckolding you. As long as she's doing her wifely duty, that's all that matters. Don't look in it too much, which means what? She's in charge. She can run her own life. She can run her own life. And be happy with that. This Nicholas gan mercy for to Crea and spak so fair and proffered him so faster that she her love him granted at a lasta. I take it back, it's within 3 lines. Okay? And swore her oath by St. Thomas of Kent that she will bane at his commandment when that she may her lesser well espeal. This is nasty. Oh, okay. I give in to you. But on my terms, when I've got free time, and I feel like it, and she swears by Thomas of Canterbury, the saint whose shrine they are going to visit, this is the miller being really nasty. Really nasty. Please notice in this tale, we have a contemporary setting that is filled with references to God and the saints. In the Knight's Tale, we had an ancient tale filled with the classical gods that told a story that was clearly of a profound Catholic vision. Here we have a contemporary setting, a story filled with references to God and the saints, and it's blasphemous. And the Miller is deliberately doing this. All of that stuff is merely external, he's saying. It doesn't mean anything. And he's obviously poking at all of those religious who are riding with him. I'll show you what your religion's worth. And they're a little, he is in his tale in opposition to almost everybody. Everybody who's riding on along with him. Her one condition, she says, my husband's so jealous, we've got to be really careful. We've got to be really careful. We've got to sneak around behind my husband, she says. Now, what is it that Nicholas is studying? We find out that he's spending all of his time studying astrology. He is, if you will, attempting to discover some of the secrets of the universe. The sort of thing where one is seeking knowledge in order to make it useful for others. If you will, he's going to figure out what it is that Providence has designed. He is seeking to know those things that are beyond man's knowledge. Again, a dig at the Knight. The Knight has said, we can't know, submit. The Miller says, hey, anybody who's smart is going to try to figure it out. If you're really smart, you're going to try to figure it out. But not to know what God has designed for you, but how you can use these things to your own end. And that's what he will do in order to fool the carpenter. But first, we meet the second suitor, okay? First, we meet the second suitor. Now was there of that church a parish clerk, the witch that was yclept Absalom? Cruel was his hair, and as the gold it shone. Wait a minute, he's got curled hair. Where we've come upon this before? He's a young man with curled hair. Now he's taking a swipe at the squire. Not only is he attacking the father's story directly, now he will make the butt of all the jokes here have certain connections with the son. So he's now mocking the squire, okay? Cruel was his hair, and as the gold it shone, and struted as a fan large and broader, full straight and even lay his jolly shoulder, okay? His roder was red, his eye and gray as gorse. He's very concerned with his appearance. He's very much aware of how he looks to the outside world. He's jolly, he's gay, he is the one who swings the censer when the wives of the parish come to special services, and when they come, he's looking at them to see which ones are the most beautiful. Again, the young man's attention is on the ladies. He's hoping to stand, if you will, in his lady's grasa, just like the squire again, very like the squire. And then he sees young Alison, the young wife, and instantly falls in love with her. And he's overcome with longing. We discover he also plays instruments and sings, again like the squire. He comes to the carpenter's house early in the morning and woos her at her window. Well, her husband's at home. I mean, this is just bald-faced. It's just extraordinary, okay? He singeth in his voice gentle and small, Nu dera ladi if thee will obey, I pray you that you will rue on me. Have mercy on me, he says. The same thing Nicholas says. We've got the two young men subject to the will of the woman, and the woman chooses this one, not that one. She just mocks him. I'm not interested. Go away, okay? Her husband wakes up and says to his wife, "What? Isn't that Absalom singing at our window? What's he doing down there?" She says, oh yeah, I hear him. And this passeth forth, what will ye beth and wail? From day to day this jolly Absalom, so woeth her that him is woe be gone. He's wooing her publicly. He's wooing her publicly. The husband's doing nothing. The husband's doing nothing. This joker is wooing his wife in public. Meanwhile, the lodger in his house is already having an affair with her. This is the vision of age and authority. Okay? Benighted, foolish, stupid. It's wonderful. Sometimes he builds a little scaffolding. He'll come and put up a little scaffolding so he can be closer up to the window to sing. Now, clearly, what have we got? We've got a fool. If we get a division here between the two young men, one is very smart and clever. He has studied to learn how to get his own ends. The other is openly idiotic so that everybody can laugh at him. They both want the same thing. Their efforts mean nothing because they are totally dependent on the will of the woman. She's in charge. She is the one who is in charge. As a result, since she is the one who is in control, I'm turning to the parson's sermon at the end. I'll just read you a little line from it. This is an example of how the sermon will eventually reflect back on all of the tales. Here we go. Now cometh how that a man should bear him with his wife. I'll read it straightforwardly. And namely in two things. That is to say, in sufferance and reverence, as showed Christ when he made the first woman. For he did not make her, Havid of Adam, for that she should not claim to great lordship. Okay? She is made after Adam, so that she cannot claim to be the first. For there is the woman has mastery. Wherever the woman has mastery, wherever the woman is in charge, she maketh to much disarray. Because what is happening is that God's order is being reversed. There needs no examples of this. The experience of day by day ought to be sufficient, says the parson. I don't have to give you examples. You see it out in the world constantly. And what the miller is presenting here is that idea, but delighting in it. Delighting in it. An 18-year-old woman is ruling everybody in this story. Her old husband and the two young men who are in love with her. And they are all beholden to her. She is in absolute charge, and she will get what she wants. And she will bestow her favors where she wants. And nobody's going to rule over her, and nobody's going to tell her what to do. And the miller delights in this, and this is the situation he sets up, and now he points out what will follow from that. And what it is, curiously, in agreement with what the parson will say in his sermon, is disarray. We're now going to head into chaos. But the miller thinks chaos is a riot. Chaos is a great laugh. The world is a place of chaos, and therefore, we should just delight in it and laugh at it. Especially if you're getting what you want and can laugh at everybody else. Pure selfishness. Pure willfulness. What happens? Nicholas locks himself up in his room. Doesn't come to meals. Nobody sees him. And old John the carpenter gets worried. What's happened? What's wrong? He goes, knocks on the door, no answer, no reply. Finally, he goes up and breaks the door down. Not with his head, I assume. He's an old man. Goes inside, and Nicholas is in a kind of trance. He's in a sort of trance. He's brought out of the trance, and he says to the old man, I've had a message from God. I have been studying the providential design of God and now I know what's coming. Okay? It's a lie. Man cannot know. It's an inappropriate study he's been doing, and now he's lying about the results. To what end? The fact that he and his beloved, the other man's wife, are tired of hiding behind his back, and they want to spend a whole night together. Question is, how do we get the husband out of the way? And he comes up with this elaborate scheme. So he says to the husband, I have seen God's design. I know what is coming. Providence has been unveiled to me. Please notice how this is an attack on the knight's tale. The knight saying very clearly, we cannot know. All we can do is submit. We submit and accept humbly what God sends. Hendy Nicholas says, I know what God is sending. It's a lie. Here's what God is sending. There is going to be a second flood. A second flood. And as God spoke to Noah, so now God, through me, tells you, you've got to prepare for the coming flood. Now, of course, what do we know? There is the promise that God would never again destroy the world by water. Nicholas says this is going to be twice as big as the first flood. You think that was bad? This is going to be twice as bad. And the old credulous man goes, oh no, oh no. What do I do? What do I do? Nicholas says, well, isn't time to build an ark. So here's what you do. You go and get three enormous buckets and hang them from the roof. One for you, one for me, one for your lovely wife. And of course, what will happen then is the water is going to come. But at a certain point, when God speaks to me and tells me now is the time, we cut the ropes and we float on the water in our buckets and we'll survive. And what does the old man do? He falls for it. And he goes off to find the three big buckets. This is already pretty funny. Okay? Why is it funny? Because we're looking at the foolishness of man. The absurd credulity of man. Capable of believing anything, no matter how idiotic. And man believing that he can get special messages from God. I know the rest of the world doesn't. How do you know? Well, because the young student who's lodging with me told me. You know, please, what? Come on. No, he falls for it. Off he goes. This sailly carpenter goeth forth his wife, full off to Isida, alas, and wail away. And to his wife he told his privité, and she was ware, and knew it bet that he, what all this quaint a cost was for to sigh. She knows what it's all. She's laughing at her husband. She's laughing. By the way, and I'm not going to point this out, I'll just say this. There are some absolutely obscene puns in Middle English buried in this story. Okay. I'll just put that out for your interest. It's loaded with them. He's not just telling the story. He's using language with double meanings at times that are just vile. And you know he's just delighting in doing it. So what do? Off we go. We construct the three barrels. We hang them up there. And then Nicholas announces, the time is at hand. The end has come. Climb up in our buckets and all. Seriously, this is funny stuff. This is funny stuff. And they all three climb up in their buckets. And immediately two of them climb back down and go up in the bedroom. Right? I mean, it's just absurd. And here's this pathetic old man shivering in his bucket, waiting for the floodwaters to come. While he's cuckolded by his wife with the young man, okay? Well, remember, when the woman rules, it leads to disorder. So they may think they're having their fun there, but another element's about to enter in, and of course young Absalom comes to the window again. He comes to the window again, as he seems to have been doing regularly, climbs up the ladder and begs for the favors of Alisun once again. And she giggles. She thinks this is wildly funny and agrees to let him have a kiss You know the result. If not, read it, okay? Let's just say the young Absalom gets what he deserves. He simply gets what he deserves. He realizes what has happened. And instantly, his love changes to rage. If we're living on the level of pure passion, those passions can swiftly change. And what we think is passionate love can become passionate anger or passionate hate. It's the reason why you'll see out in the world young couples who are dedicated, devoted, deeply in love one day, the next day will be ripping each other to pieces and doing everything they can to destroy each other's lives. Because how can this be? Well, because if you're simply living on the level of passion, those passions can switch their ends very quickly. Young Absalom no longer loves his beloved. He wants to get revenge on her. And so he goes off and gets a coulter, a plow pike, and heats it up red hot, okay? Climbs up the window again and begs for a second kiss. And of course, Hendy Nicholas, being very clever, thinks, let me give him the kiss this time, and gets his proper reward. Okay? The beauty of the design of this story is that it is very craftily, and I mean with craft, constructed. He gets the burning plow pike in his behind and shrieks out, "Water!" Whereupon the old carpenter cuts the rope, thinking the flood has come. Only, of course, he doesn't simply land on the waters and get carried off. He tumbles from the roof to the ground and breaks his arm. Notice what we have here. Look at the three men. We have young Absalom, who is absolutely humiliated and has learned that what he thought was love is not love at all. And will bear that mark of humiliation for the rest of his days. His love has been turned to anger and hatred. We've got Hendy Nicholas, who thought he was absolutely in control of everything in the world around him, who has quite literally gotten burned and well deserves it. We have old John the carpenter, who thought he knew God's design and what God intended. And not only has he tumbled from his roof in this bucket and is lying on the ground with a broken arm, but all of his friends and neighbors come and see him and stand and laugh at him. And he is publicly humiliated. And who is it that escapes unscathed? The young wife. She's gotten everything she's wanted. She is not punished in any way. And this is the moral, if you will, of the Miller's tale. The women are going to win out in the end. The women are going to get what they want. So don't ask questions. If you're married, just let your wife do whatever she wants. Let her go her way. And as long as she's good to you, that's all that matters. So you settle for the little bit that your wife gives you and don't ask questions. Don't try to know God's providence. Don't worry about big religious questions. Don't worry about how your wife is behaving in the world. Just get your own desires satisfied and be content with that. Because the fact of the matter is, as the Miller posits here in his tale, the world's chaos. And this is finally, this is where he sneers. At the night, okay? There is no providential design. There is no order. You go out in the world and you're going to find a place of absolute chaos and disorder, and all you can hope to do is make your own way in it as cleverly and as well as you can to get what you want. I guess you could say it's a very popular theory now in science. It's called chaos theory. Well, we find it here in the Miller's Tale. It's what the Miller is asserting. There is no order. There is only chaos. Bernard Huppé, again, refers to this as the road to Babylon. The road to Babylon. Disorder. Chaos. And says, and I think it's absolutely true, the first two tales present the two ways. The Knight's Tale, the high road to Jerusalem, the vision of God's providence and design to which the humble soul submits and trusts in God and accepts what the world hands, what God gives. And the other way, the Miller's way, which is the low road to Babylon. The world is chaos and confusion. There's no order. There is only what you want, so get as much as you can. And enjoy enjoy your time. Now, his tale ends, the very end of his tale. Thus suived was this carpenteress weef for all his caping and his jealousia. There's no point in trying to keep your wife at home. There's no point in being jealous. This is his reward. This is what he gets. And Absalom hath kissed her nether ear, and Nicholas is scalded in the tuta. This tala is done, and God save all the ruta. That's how it ends up. So there I finish my tale, and God save the whole lot of them. And even that final sentence, obviously given with a kind of sneer. Now we do get a reaction to the tale. When folk had a lochven at this Nisa Kass of Absalom and Hendy Nicholas, diverse folk diversely thy side, but for the more part they laugh and play. Everybody laughs. Everybody has a good laugh at the Miller's Tale. But many of them have different opinions about it. But for the most part, they just laughed and said it was a good story. And that's all we get. And then the reeve attacks the miller. But please notice, again, the miller's vision leads to an increased world of division and anger. He's attacked everybody, now the reeve turns on him, and we're going to have a whole series of little battles among the pilgrims for the rest of the journey. It's going to continue. So that there we have it, the first two tales, the two separate roads, if you will. But the fact of the matter is, whether the miller likes it or not, he's still going to end up at Canterbury. He is still moving in one direction. He's going to end up the same place they all end up. And he may believe the world is only confusion and chaos and disorder. Therefore, get what you want. That may be the song he sings, the music he plays as they leave London. But this road is one way. This road is one way. And he's going to Canterbury. He's going to the Holy Shrine. That's where he will end. That's where he will end. And we cannot say those are simply two different visions. We have to say, and Chaucer will make very clear through the rest of the tales, one of the visions is true, and one of the visions is false. And in the way he presents them from the beginning, it is very clear that it is the Knight's Tale we are to listen to and believe. That's the first pillar of the work. The second pillar reflecting it will be the great Parson's sermon at the end. Now, in the second lecture this morning, we'll look at the wife of Bath, who is giving a different vision, but directly connected with the miller's vision. Okay? We are now going to meet not the pretty young 18-year-old thing. We're going to meet a real woman living in a real world.